Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. When you hear that music, you know something good is about to happen. That's our Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin music from Eric and Nato, who wrote that music and produced that music for us. Thank you, Eric and Nato. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Hello and welcome.
Hello, Cy Kellett, and welcome.
Thank you very much. And it's time for Weird Questions again. You all excited
I'm all
about
set.
That? I love that music. I think it's so nice to have special music for our Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Here's how Weird Question works, first of all. I guess I should explain that to you. We're not going to take calls today. All of these have come to us via the internet one way or another. So I'll read the questions to Jimmy, and Jimmy will answer them. And then on occasions, the Weird Questions music will play. We'll do some ads and all that. So in almost every way, a normal show, except not normal at all, because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, of course, in addition to being senior apologist here, is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where you can find more weird stuff all the time. Every Friday, new weird stuff coming out. How's everything going at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Oh, the Mysterious World continues to turn.
It does.
As the Mysterious World turns.
You know what? That makes me think. Since I don't know, something about you saying the world turns makes me think of this.
The old soap opera, As the World Turns?
Well, yes, of course. The famous
people.
I don't actually know anything about it. But did you know this? There's something about the core of the Earth is bulging on one side. Did you hear about this?
Oh, yeah.
Is this a problem? Is this something I should be aware of?
Well, while hypothetically it could have some minor consequences in the future, it's not something we have to worry about in our lifetimes.
The soothing voice of Jimmy Akin assuring me that the Earth is not going to bulge apart. All right. You ready for some weird questions, Jimmy?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. This one comes from Anonymous. Suppose there is a person that, while they are asleep and dreaming, has the capacity to recognize that they are having a dream and to guide their actions within the dream. How would sinful actions in their dream affect their regular life? For example, if a person is married, we get the idea. Do you want me to keep going?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. For example, if a person is married and one night had a dream with a celebrity in it that they find attractive, would it be sinful to act on their feelings within the dream? If it's not inherently sinful, would it maybe just be a bad idea because it might open the door to similar behaviors in their regular life?
Okay. So having control of what happens in your dreams is a real phenomenon. It's known as lucid dreaming,
okay,
where you realize you're in a dream and you can exert control over it potentially, or you just wake up once you realize you're in a dream. But as soon as you realize you're in a dream, it's a state of lucid dreaming. This technique can be learned. And so it is possible for people to do this kind of thing voluntarily. It's not discussed in the standard moral pastoral theologies in detail that I'm aware of. But even absent lucid dreaming, there are things people could do or think they could do historically to influence what they might dream about. You know,
okay.
Even if you're not in a dream state and you're not in control of it, you could kind of prep yourself for a dream, being in a dream state before you actually go to bed, or as you're lying in bed. And the conclusion that moral theologians have come to on this question is if you are prepping yourself for having dreams about behavior that would be sinful in real life, it would be sinful to do that. Because essentially you're setting yourself up for a future fantasy of a sinful nature. And Jesus said, you know, if you commit adultery with a woman in your heart, it's still a sin.
Yeah.
So this would be like priming yourself for having that kind of fantasy in a dream state, and it doesn't therefore relieve you of moral responsibility.
Right.
The same thing would be true if you're in a dream state and you are in full control of yourself morally and choose to make the dream go in an immoral direction.
Yeah.
But that's actually a bit of a different question because you may not be in full moral control of yourself. You may only be partially in control. So in order to commit a mortal sin, you have to have the deliberate use of reason. And even though it may feel at times in dreams that you have the deliberate use of reason, you really don't. It's kind of like when people are drunk and they may feel fully in control of themselves, but they're not.
Right. Okay.
And,
gotcha.
And so if you're having a lucid dream, and you make a decision on the spur of the moment, you know, that's not something you had planned before going to sleep, you may not have the moral control over yourself that you think you do.
Oh, okay. All right. So if you become aware in a dream that you're dreaming, that's called a lucid dream.
Yes.
All right. I did that one time. Only one time, though.
Oh.
And when I was a kid, I had a dream and I realized that it was a dream. And I wanted to get out of it. And I thought, well, the only way to do that is to pop the sky.
Okay.
Like I thought, like it was like a bubble of dream. I had to pop it.
Okay.
But I couldn't figure out how to pop the sky. So I don't know. I don't know what happened after that.
I have lucid dreams periodically. I normally don't have much control over them, though. I tend to either think, oh, it would be neat for this to happen, and then it doesn't.
Yeah.
Or I just wake up once I realize it's a dream.
Oh, yeah.
But it is a trainable skill. And it can be useful for people like who have post-traumatic stress disorder or chronic nightmares.
Yeah, to learn how not to do certain things.
Exactly.
Yeah, go in a different direction. Anonymous, thank you very much for that question. Let's up next is John. I'm just going to Darren. I'm correct, right? I'm going to John. Okay. I saw this morning in discussion with Father Mark Goring about aliens. My question is this. If there are aliens out there and they're just God's creatures like us and the angels, as Jimmy Akin said, they'd also worship the one true God, the Trinity, just as we do, right?
Okay, so that's the first part of his question. There's another part. But in response to the first part of his question, so he's referring to an interview I did with Father Mark Goring on YouTube about aliens. And if intelligent aliens exist, we don't know what their religion would be any more than we would know what an uncontacted tribe here on Earth would have as their religion. So with some tribes, God may have revealed himself to them. He may or may not have revealed the Trinity to them because, you know, there was a time here on Earth with the Jewish people before the Trinity had been clearly revealed. So he might reveal himself to people on another planet in the same way he had revealed himself to the Jewish people before the time of Christ. He might have revealed the Trinity to them the way he did at the time of Christ.
Right.
He might not have revealed himself to them the way the tribes, for example, in the Americas were in the first century. So we really don't know. I would guess that for most races, he's made himself known in some way, but the details could vary from race to race.
Okay, so the second part of his question, but the second person of the Blessed Trinity would have what for them, would be an alien body, the God-man Jesus Christ. I mean, how would they deal with a God who looked like us and not like them? Wouldn't that be kind of weird for them?
Well, it could be kind of weird for them. That would depend on their sense of aesthetics, and presumably their sense of aesthetics would be based on the life forms on their planet. And so to learn that God had incarnated as a human and only as a human could seem weird to them. On the other hand, it's really just an extension of a principle we have here on Earth, because even within the one human race, we have subraces. And Jesus incarnated as only one subrace. He incarnated as a Jewish person. So if you're from a different culture, if you're not a Jewish person, Jesus is in some way from a different genetic population than you are, even here on Earth. Some genetic populations are closer or more distant to the Jewish genetic population of the first century. So there's a little bit of that principle even here on Earth. It would just be a further extension of it with aliens who are even more genetically diverse from us. Having said that, you'll notice that I mentioned if God had incarnated as a human and only as a human.
Yes.
But it's not impossible for God to incarnate wherever he chooses because he's omnipotent. And so he could have parallel incarnations on other worlds if he chose to do that. The only one we know about, at least right now, is Jesus. but it's not impossible that he could have incarnated elsewhere. And in fact, there have been science fiction novels devoted to exploring the possibility of what would it be like if Jesus incarnated in another species.
Ah, very good. Okay, John, thank you very much. There's a original Star Trek episode that ends with
That's
the sun.
Bread and Circuses, and they find this planet of Romans in the 20th century technology.
Yeah.
They keep hearing about these sun worshipers, and the stinger for the episode is when Lieutenant Uhura, who's been monitoring their radio broadcasts, reveals it's not the sun in the sky they're worshiping, it's the Son of God.
Okay, we'll take a quick break. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
EWTN is now on Twitter. Get short, timely messages from EWTN on your computer or cell phone. It's easy to stay up to date on a wide variety of topics. Pro-life news, Vatican announcements, catechesis, apologetics, the latest EWTN programming, and more. You can link to EWTN on Twitter from our homepage or go to twitter.com/EWTN. At work, at home, at school, and on the road, stay connected to your world with EWTN's Twitter page.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. That's our Weird Questions music. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And I read Jimmy the Weird Questions, but the Weird Questions come to us from folks all over the world. They come right via email or some other instrument of the internet. And up next, this question comes from Michelle. If all matter were smaller and hotter prior to the Big Bang, like if I think what she's saying is if the whole universe was in a hot, dense state.
Yeah. Yeah. About 13 billion years ago, and then expansion started. Wait.
Then could it have contained life forms at those temperatures, or was life introduced after matter cooled enough to support life as we know it?
So from our understanding of how hot it was when the Big Bang occurred and very shortly thereafter, it was actually so hot that...
How hot was it? Sorry, that's the old Johnny Carson thing.
Indeed, yes. It was so hot that the universe actually could not have atoms form. And for the first 300,000 years, the universe was actually dark because light could not propagate. It was so dense. The energy density was so high. And so you didn't actually have the lights turn on until about 300,000 years into the process. And that's what gave us the cosmic microwave background radiation. It's the image of the first burst of light once the universe became diffuse enough to allow light to move from one place to another.
That is so weird.
So if there was any life at this time, it would have had to be very different from anything we understand as life. Having said that, the universe then decreased in temperature as it expanded, and it did pass through a range where the average temperature would have been consistent, for example, with water-based life. The question would then be, was there enough of the right elements for water-based life to exist when the universe was at the right temperature? And because water is hydrogen and oxygen, and hydrogen was the primordial element that formed along with some helium and a little bit of lithium, but oxygen is element 8, and so oxygen was not produced at the Big Bang or in the wake of the Big Bang, what's called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Instead, oxygen is produced by stellar nucleosynthesis, where stars squeeze hydrogen and helium together to make heavier elements like oxygen. And then at the end of the star's life, it starts releasing those elements into space. So my understanding is that that you didn't have enough of the right kinds of elements in space when the universe was at the right temperature for this to happen. But there have been speculations about could there have been some sort of life when the universe was a balmy 70 degrees on average? And the answer is we don't know, but it's something people have thought about.
Fascinating. Michelle, thank you very much.
And she has a part two as well.
Here we go. Here's part two from Michelle's question. If all matter comes from the Big Bang, I assume that matter was sent in all directions. So are stars and matter that exploded towards the opposite direction from us visible to us and appearing as moving away from us faster than matter, moving in the same direction as we are? What a great question, Michelle.
She has a key insight here. It's not quite the way, she's not articulating it quite the way modern cosmologists would, because the way she seems to be visualizing it, it's like all of the matter in the universe was at a single point and then began expanding away from that point. And so far as we can tell, that doesn't appear to be what's happened. Instead, if you think about the surface of a balloon, when it's very small and it's got dots on the balloon, and then you blow up the balloon, well, the dots are all getting farther apart from each other as the balloon expands, but there's not a single point on the surface of the balloon where they're all expanding away from that point. Right. Instead, they're all expanding away from every point on the surface of the balloon. So I wouldn't say that there are, or at least it's not quite the way that astronomers conceive of it to say there was matter that was moving in the opposite direction from us at the Big Bang. Instead, all the matter started moving away from each other. Having said that, she's right. The farther away you go from Earth, the faster everything seems to be receding because there's more space and thus there's more space to be expanding. And so the farther away something is, the faster it appears to be moving away from us. And in fact, some galaxies are so far away from us that they are moving at faster than the speed of light, and we can never see them. In fact, because of the expansion of the universe, every second, I think it is, something like 20,000 galaxies cross that threshold where they are moving faster away from us than the speed of light, and they slip over the cosmic horizon, never to be seen again. And if you ask, well, how can this happen faster than light? Well, matter can't be accelerated to be faster than light, but space is not matter, and so space can expand in a way that over a cosmic distances, something can be moving faster than the speed of light. It's not moving in its own frame of reference faster than the speed of light, but the frame of references between us and them are moving away faster.
It's so big.
It is really big.
You really like the scale of the universe, both on the on the microscopic level and then on that macroscopic level. It's you really can't hold it in your mind. It's just baffling. Yep. Maybe in your mind. I don't know.
Yeah, only with powers of 10.
Yeah, right. Okay, Lauren's got a question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. If Jesus sits at the right hand of God, Lauren asks, who sits on the left?
Well, we're not told, and it's possible that the answer, hypothetically, the answer could be nobody, because simply saying Jesus sits at the right hand of God doesn't necessarily, because God doesn't literally have hands.
Yeah.
This is a metaphor. And there's a question of how far do you extend the metaphor? We may not be meant to extend it beyond simply what's given to us, which is Jesus sitting at the right hand of God, implying he has this special place of authority relative to God the Father. However, we know there's a Trinity, and so the Holy Spirit would have something analogous, and consequently, in various images from Christian history, the Holy Spirit is depicted as sitting at God's left hand, since the Son proceeds from the Father, and the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, or through the Son. So that could suggest the Holy Spirit would have a similar but different position of authority relative to the Father and the Son, and that's often depicted in Christian imagery as being on God's left hand. In fact, the earliest reference to that I'm aware of, I believe, is in the Ascension of Isaiah, which was written about the year AD 67, when in that work Isaiah ascends up to the top heaven and sees the throne of God. He sees the Son sitting on the right hand and the Holy Spirit sitting on the left hand of the Father.
Lauren, great question. Thank you very, very much. It is Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. Here's one from Colin, and this one's pretty weird too. I was wondering if it would be the sin of presumption to attempt to travel into the future. Since we don't know when Christ is returning and can't know that a particular future time will exist. Colin, thinking it through, I like it.
Yeah, so I don't think that it would be the sin of presumption because we're already moving into the future.
Yeah.
And I mean, that happens every single second. Despite the song, time does not keep slipping into the future. It keeps slipping into the past because we're moving forward in time. And at some point, we'll hit the second coming of Christ. Now, as we learned from Albert Einstein, it's possible to travel into the future faster from a subjective perspective. Because if you go deep into a gravity well, or if you travel, if you accelerate near the speed of light, time slows down for you, even though it's passing at its normal rate elsewhere in the universe. And so if you and I got on a spaceship and started traveling, let's say at one gravity, we're accelerating at one gravity, so it's nice and comfortable for us.
Right.
Gradually, we're going to approach the speed of light, and time will start slowing down for you and me, but it's going to keep passing at its normal rate back on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that for us, we're moving into the future faster than we normally are. So it might be a year for you and me on the spaceship, but it would be, you know, say 1,000 years back on Earth.
Right, right. Gotcha.
And so when we decelerate the ship, it's 1,000 years later, even though it's been only a year for you and me. Well, if we can do that, at some point, the same thing would happen. We'd hit the second coming of Christ, and whenever that occurs, we're going to have to deal with the consequences. And so let's suppose we had planned a voyage that wouldn't get back to Earth until after the second coming, because we don't know when that is. So let's say the second coming is going to happen in the year 2500, but we've planned on getting back in 3000. Well, presumably, since we're humans, we're tied into, we're going to have our judgment when the second coming happens. So Jesus comes back in the year 2500, and you and I are grabbed, just like all of the Christians from all over the world are grabbed, according to St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 4, to be with Jesus. So we're yanked off the spaceship, and we experience the second coming. Well, what would happen if we were, like on Doctor Who, we were traveling into the future without passing through all that intervening time, essentially teleporting from now to the year 3000. My guess would be in the teleport process, we would again be grabbed and taken to the year 25,000 or 2500 to experience the second coming. In any event, I don't think it would be presumptuous because one way or another, Jesus is going to make sure that we get our final judgment and entry into the eternal order. And merely the fact of moving into the future and not knowing when the second coming is going to happen isn't enough to establish presumption because we're already doing that.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right. Well, thank you very much for the question, Colin. Appreciate it. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. These weird questions come to us all different ways. Jimmy gathers them up, and then we ask them on Weird Question Day. And Rob is next. And Rob says, given that Mary is the Ark of the New Covenant, would God have placed a punishment upon touching her as he did with the Ark of the Old Covenant, a la Uzzah?
Okay, so this is referring to an event that occurs in Samuel where David is having the Ark of the Covenant brought up from a particular location, and they're dragging it on a cart that's being pulled by oxen, and the oxen stumble, and one of the sons of the priest, a guy named Uzzah, touches the Ark with his hands to steady it because the oxen have stumbled and he doesn't want it to fall on the ground, and Uzzah then dies because he's touched the Ark. So that's what's going on there. Now, people may have the idea that the mere fact Uzzah touched the Ark was like anybody who would touch the Ark would die.
Yeah.
And that's not the case because the Ark had previously been captured by the Philistines and they did not treat it the way they should, but they also didn't immediately die the way Uzzah did. What is clarified in Chronicles is that the reason Uzzah died is because they weren't transporting the ark properly. rather than using oxen, they were supposed to insert poles through these rings they had on the ark, and then the Levites would carry the poles on their shoulders.
Right.
And they're not doing that. So David clarifies in Chronicles that the reason Uzzah died is because they were disobeying known protocols that God had revealed to the Israelites. So applying that to Mary, or Jesus, who can also be conceived of as the Ark of the Covenant, mm-hmm. I don't think you would automatically die for touching them.
Right.
What you might automatically die for is touching them in some really horrendous way. However, maybe not even then, because the Romans drove spikes through Jesus,
right.
and they didn't automatically die when that happened. So even Jesus is certainly greater than Mary, whether you want to conceive of him also as the Ark of the Covenant or not, Jesus is certainly greater than Mary, and physically torturing him and driving spikes through him didn't result in instant death.
Right.
So I don't think this is like any other analogy. It can't be pressed beyond its limits,
yeah.
and I don't think we could draw certain conclusions based on just the fact there's an analogy here.
Thanks, Rob. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin continues right after this.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
According to divine command, we should give God worship, but how do we know if we're doing it right? Is worship a form of self-help? To make me feel better? A form of social activism or even a commodity? Or is it something that transcends all of those? In Real Religion, How to Avoid False Faith and Worship God in Spirit and Truth, Father Jeff Kirby cuts through the misguided modern notions about God and religion and takes you back to the foundation for true worship, God's revelation about himself. From his first contact with his chosen people to the culmination of his revelation in Jesus Christ, God shows us what religion is supposed to be like and how to make the practice of it a lifelong virtue in our lives. Order your copy of Real Religion by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. All of our questions are of a weird nature. People send them to us just for this purpose, for those times when we do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. This next one comes from Sarah. Sarah says, my girls have a question for Jimmy. They want to know if Bucky Barnes from Marvel would be morally responsible for the violence and mayhem he caused while under a trance. Specifically, would he need to go to confession? Would he go to hell for the crimes he committed while under a trance?
Okay, so we should mention who Bucky Barnes is. Bucky Barnes, back in the 1940s, was the sidekick of Captain America. And he apparently died at the same time Captain America vanished. And for years and years in comics, there was a saying, because comic book characters so often come back from the dead,
yeah.
nobody stays dead except Bucky and Uncle Ben. And then eventually they brought back Bucky, and they gave him a new identity for a while as a character called the Winter Soldier, and that involved some mind control, and then they made a movie about it. Well, so in order for what you need to confess when you go to confession is mortal sin. And in order for mortal sin to be committed, three conditions have to be met. You have to know the moral character of the act you performed. You have to know that it's gravely sinful. It has to be gravely sinful, and you have to do it deliberately anyway. There's a fancy term that theologians sometimes use. They will say you have to do it as a fully human act, meaning you're fully in control of yourself and you decide to do it anyway. It wasn't like something you did when you were intoxicated or spontaneously or reflexively or in the heat of passion or anything that could diminish either your knowledge of the moral character of the act or the degree of consent you gave it will keep the sin from being mortal and you don't need to confess it. So if you're in a trance, if you're under some form of mind control, that's going to either affect your knowledge of how wrong it is, or it's going to affect your ability to resist doing it.
Yeah.
Or both.
Right.
And so if you're, quote-unquote, in a trance, then you're not going to be fully responsible for it, and it will not be a mortal sin, and you will not need to confess it, and you would not go to hell because you were not in control of yourself. Having said that, you may feel bad after getting back into your right mind and realizing what you did when you were out of your right mind.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like if you were, let's say you were a sleepwalker, and you didn't realize it, but one night you were sleepwalking and you got behind the wheel of your car and you got in a wreck and you killed someone.
You'd feel terrible.
Well, even though you weren't responsible for that, you would still feel bad. And so you might need some psychological counseling or spiritual counseling to help you put that in context and get over it, but it wouldn't have been a mortal sin for you.
Sarah, thanks very much for the question. And Sarah's girls, thank you very much for that question. I hope that settles your mind as far as Bucky Barnes goes. I'm not giving out the number today because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and all the questions have been submitted already. Our up next is a question from Paul. Paul writes, Jimmy, after my six-year-old was born with Down syndrome, I wondered if he would have Down syndrome in heaven or in his resurrected body. At first, I thought not, since it's caused by an extra chromosome in the body, which is not part of the soul. But I've recently come to understand that the church says our bodies are a fundamental part of our eternal existence. And certainly our intellectual capability affects our desire and ability to seek God. Will people with intellectual or physical disabilities have the same or similar disabilities in heaven or after they are resurrected from the dead? And would his intellectual disability necessarily get him a get out of hell free card?
So in regard to the first question, the church doesn't have a specific teaching on this, but the general understanding of theologians is that any disabilities we have in this life will not affect us in heaven. At least the historical speculation from theologians like Aquinas and other people was that our resurrected bodies will be perfect. They'll neither have the limitations of youth nor the limitations of old age. And they won't have diseases. They'll be basically in perfect adult prime condition. Having said that, we do know that in Jesus's resurrected body, he at least at times manifested the wounds from the cross because Thomas puts his finger into them, in John chapter 20.
Right.
On the other hand, other times when Jesus appears and they don't recognize him, they don't notice any wounds. So it looks like for Jesus, the wounds may come and go. And as a result, my personal speculation would be that that the bedrock condition of being in heaven is any limitations we have in this life, like Down syndrome or other things, will not affect or will not diminish the happiness we have in heaven. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line one. We're not going to be suffering in heaven. And we likely or may well be able to manifest in different ways like it seemed Jesus did, where we could appear kind of any way we want to, You know, so I would say if Jesus wanted to manifest his nail wounds, he could. I would suggest if he wanted to appear as a young man, he could, or a baby, he could. I would think our physical forms are going to be subject to our wills at that point, wow, and we can manifest them however we like. That's okay. My guess anyway. That's not church teaching.
And then the second part, he wants to know.
Yes. So in this life, someone with Down syndrome is not going to have the full use of reason, and as a result, will not be able to commit mortal sin in this life. So if the person has the grace of God in their soul, such as through baptism, then they're not capable of excluding the grace of God from their soul, and thus they would automatically go to heaven.
Paul, thank you very much. God bless you and your son. I hope that both of those answers were helpful to you. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Up next, from Mickey: regarding the reported sightings and confirmations of the UFOs, UAPs, is it possible that they are angels? I understand that angels are incredibly fast and intelligent. Nonetheless, I can understand if they are not angels.
So this is something people often wonder about. In particular, they'll wonder, are UFOs fallen angels or uh-huh. demons? What we know about angels is they are telekinetic life forms. They, even though they don't have bodies themselves, they can manipulate matter. And so they're created intellects. They don't have natively any body at all. But we see in the Bible that they can manipulate matter. They can assume temporary physical forms. You can touch them, like in when Lot has them over for dinner, and they're yanking Lot to get him away from Sodom before it gets destroyed.
Right.
Or when in the time of David, an angel is administering a plague, and plagues are caused by microorganisms. So the angel is manipulating microorganisms.
Oh,
and right. In Matthew's gospel, an angel rolls away the stone.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that angels can manipulate matter, and apparently they can create temporary bodies for themselves. St. Thomas Aquinas and other theologians of his era referred to these as aerial bodies. They like took the matter in the air and condensed it mm-hmm. to make a temporary body, and then they would release it when they were done with the body. And their bodies don't always necessarily need to look human. Now, we see them appearing as humans in, like, the Gospels, for example, when they appear at the tomb. But we also see angels, at least in visions, depicted in other forms, like the cherubim and the seraphim, mm-hmm. that are kind of mixtures of human and animal forms.
Right.
And presumably they could make aerial bodies that look like that too. So I would say that if, based on what we know about angels' abilities, if they wanted to manipulate matter to appear as a glowing light in the sky, or even to appear as a nuts and bolts craft,
yeah,
they could do that. As I don't have any reason to say they couldn't. So on that basis, I would say, well, it's hypothetically possible that some unidentified flying objects are angels, fallen or unfallen. However, my question would be, what evidence do we have that that's the case? You could take any phenomena in the world and propose that it's secretly an angel.
And
sometimes you might be right. I mean, you could propose, let's say you invite a couple of people over for dinner, you could suppose that they're really angels in human form.
Right.
Well, that happened a lot. That happened to Lot. But on the other hand, it does not happen a lot.
Yeah.
Most of the people that you invite over to dinner are not angels with aerial bodies disguising themselves.
Right.
And so the approach that I take to things is to say we need to take every phenomenon at face value until we get evidence that we should take it some other way.
Okay.
And so I would say, do UFOs fit what we read about angels doing in the Bible? Because UFOs, basically, they either appear to be nuts and bolts craft, or they appear to be lights in the sky. Do we ever have records of angels doing that in Scripture? And we don't. Mm-hmm. There are no passages that depict angels as glowing lights in the sky or as nuts and bolts craft. So it's not in keeping with the biblical precedent for what angels tend to do. And as a result of that, I would say if you want to propose that a particular UFO sighting is best explained by an angel, then you would need some kind of evidence to support that interpretation as opposed to another interpretation.
Mickey, thank you very much for the question. Thanks to everybody who has submitted questions. We got a bunch more. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. Lots and lots more weirdness coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I just want to share that 5 years ago, my lovely warrior princess and saint of a wife and I decided to adopt a little girl through foster care. She is the perfect round out of our family of three boys and her. Yes, there are challenges. Very grateful today for all the blessings that he has shown our family.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Is that a theremin?
Theremin.
That is, I believe that is a theremin. That's the music from Eric and Nato, who made the theme song for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, which we get to do from time to time and are doing right now. Jimmy, a lot of good weird questions so far.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I like them. Kevin wants to know this. How many time machine questions have we had thus far? If I happen to have a time machine and went back to the 16th century, would I be morally justified in kidnapping Martin Luther and bringing him back to my own time in order to stop the Reformation?
So this is kind of a variant of the let's kill Hitler thought experiment. If there's some, I'm not going to comment on Luther in particular because it's kind of inflammatory, but extracting the principle, if you know that someone is going to undertake action that will cause long-lasting bad results, and you have time traveled to when that person lives, can you take action to intervene to stop the bad results?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to depend on how time travel works. If time travel it operates in such a way that you cannot change the past, then you may as well not bother intervening because no matter what you try, it will not affect the outcome. On the other hand, if time travel works in such a way that you can change the past, the most logical explanation for how that would work is what you're really doing is creating a new timeline where history goes differently, and you are transferred onto that new timeline where history goes differently. Now, points for thinking of kidnapping rather than just killing Martin Luther, because there are sublethal ways of dealing with problems, and we want to use the sublethal ways if we can. Maybe give Martin Luther a course in 21st century Catholic apologetics or something.
Right.
Having said that, I would say if time travel works in such a way that history can be changed, then you would be justified in intervening to head off bad situations. So let's take it down to the small scale, and I think it'll be clear. Let's suppose I was transported back to the night of August 8th or 9th, 1969, at 10,050 Cielo Drive in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Have any idea what happened there?
Manson.
Manson murders. Yep. Okay. That was the night that Manson's goons killed J. Sebring, Wojciech Frykowski, Abigail Folger, and Sharon Tate and her unborn baby. And so let's suppose I and a SWAT team were transported back to that night.
Yes.
Could I and the SWAT team stop these murderers from killing somebody or these four people? I would say, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
If history can be changed, we can save those people's lives.
Right.
And if you want to say, oh, well, that's a famous one, well, then imagine a non-famous case. Let's suppose you time travel back and you see a murderer about to kill some random person.
Right.
Could you intervene? If history can be changed, yeah. Now, will that stop the existence of the timeline where they died? No. That timeline is still out there. It's fixed. That can't be undone, because if it could be undone, it would generate paradoxes. This is why scientists who theorize about this propose you're creating an alternative timeline, because otherwise paradoxes result.
Yeah.
And to avoid the paradoxes, you need to propose an alternate timeline. So what you're really doing is creating an alternate timeline where that person gets a chance to live. And I would say that's still a moral value. Having said that, there's no guarantee that just because you think a change is going to be an improvement, that it will actually be an improvement, because there can be unintended consequences to actions. And so, okay, let's go with the random nobody situation. You save a random nobody from being killed. That's a good thing to do, but maybe the random nobody is the next Hitler.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and right. And so yeah. There's no guarantee, just like in real life, there's no guarantee that your intervention in a given situation is going to lead to a better result. It may lead to a worse result or an equally bad result, but you don't know that. What you have to do in the present is make the decision that seems best to you based on what you know. And if you were to travel to the past, and it could be changed, I would say the same thing would apply. You need to make the best decision you can based on what you know.
All right. But if you can save Sharon Tate, save her.
Absolutely.
All right. Fair enough. Thanks for the time machine question, Kevin. Very, very helpful.
Now I'm trying to think of the movie that Quentin Tarantino did.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood,
where Sharon actually gets to live.
Yeah. That's what I think Tarantino does, is he changes historical outcomes, often with flamethrowers.
In that movie, yes.
Flamethrowers
just once, it's nice to see the Manson family get the snot beat out of them.
Right, by Brad Pitt. Do you want to do that? Would you say we have time to do Todd's question? You think?
Well, we've got 10 minutes left in the show.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Very good. Todd asks this. Could the St. Gertrude Purgatory Prayer Could the St. Gertrude Purgatory Prayer be proof of intelligent life elsewhere? Follow my logic. The prayer is traditionally said to release 1,000 souls from purgatory. There are around 1.2 billion Catholics on Earth. Let's say 50% practice. That's 600 million. Of those, let's say 10% know about this prayer. That's 60 million. Let's say 10% of those actually say it on a regular basis. That's 6 million. Well, 6 million times 1,000 souls is 6 billion souls. It's estimated that around 108 billion people have ever lived on Earth. So today's 6 million people regularly saying the prayer would only have to say it 18 times in their entire life to cover everyone who ever lived. I say the prayer between every rosary decade, so perhaps we are praying for all the souls all over the universe since we've already covered everyone here. Or maybe I'm misinterpreting the promise of this prayer. That is a perfect question for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin.
So I really appreciate Todd's doing the math on this, and he's done some research. He's right that it's estimated that around 108 billion people have lived in world history. So there are a few things to say. For people who may not be aware, Gertrude the Great was a Benedictine nun from Germany who lived in the 1200s. And it is claimed that she was told that if she said this prayer, it would release 10,000 souls from purgatory.
Okay.
It did not say that if anybody said it.
Oh.
That this would happen. So there's one possible reason that the logic might not follow. In addition, the claim that she was told this is not found in her writings.
Oh.
She didn't I was told, I had this vision and this is what I was told. It is it it it's a legend.
Mm-hmm.
And so it should not be considered historically reliable. So there's a second reason that the logic may not follow. Also, in 1899, and I looked this up, the Sacred Congregation for Indulgences and Relics, which was the relevant body at the Vatican at the time, said that promises like this are not to be credited. So the faithful should not assume that just because it's claimed that a prayer is going to have this kind of effect, that it actually will.
Okay.
And that's something that strikes a lot of people, including the Sacred Congregation for Indulgences and the Rites, back before, this is pre-Vatican II, you know,
yeah.
It struck them as superstitious.
Yeah.
And they said the faithful should not give credit to these things. So there's a third reason why the logic might not follow. Then let's get away from the boring stuff and into the really weird stuff.
Let's get away from all that boring Catholic stuff.
even if all this was true, if God did promise that if anybody says this prayer, it'll coincide with the release of 1,000 souls from purgatory, that doesn't mean that it was the only that your prayer was the only one contributing to the release of somebody.
Right.
Let's suppose Charles Manson is in purgatory.
Okay.
And he may need, well, why not?
Oh, yeah, sure.
He may need a lot of people praying for him.
Right.
To help him get out of purgatory.
Yeah.
And so maybe your prayer of this particular devotion contributed to that, but maybe somebody else's did too. So even if it was true that upon the saying of this prayer, 1,000 people get out of purgatory, that doesn't mean that it was just your prayer alone that was contributing to that. Also, there's another escape route from the logic. Also, who says that Todd has proposed other creatures out elsewhere in the universe could be being released from
right.
purgatory.
Yeah.
But why not people in the future? Because God is outside of time.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so even though there's only been 108 billion, there will be a point in the not-too-distant future where there's been 216 billion people,
yeah.
or even more than that. So it could be people in the future are getting released.
432 billion.
Yeah, indeed.
That was a quick
question. 864.
Okay, you win. I'm not playing anymore.
Okay. If alternate timelines are real, it could be people in alternate timelines.
Yeah.
And it could be people in other dimensions. So we're not limited to just the people who've lived so far and the people who might be living on other planets. So I think it's a very interesting, creative exercise, and I appreciate the math that Todd did and the research he did. I think that's great.
Right.
I do think there are multiple reasons, though, why it might not follow. And in fact, I actually do I don't know if I've mentioned this. I think I maybe have once or twice, but I have a private devotion that I've come up with on my own, and I won't say.
Oh, you have mentioned this one time.
I won't say the whole thing, but as part of it, every day I try to pray for everybody who has asked my prayers or would want my prayer or who would benefit from prayer across all times and worlds. Because God is in charge of all times and worlds, and He can apply my prayer to whenever it's needed. And
right.
so I try to do that every day as part of my own personal devotions.
I really liked this question, and I appreciated the math as well. I appreciated that you did that. You calculated it out. I wonder how they calculate that 108 billion people have ever lived. That's pretty complicated stuff.
The calculation is interesting. It's based on a variety of inputs from different pieces of historical data. It's easily possible, though, to figure. I mean, so there was a physicist in the 20th century named Enrico Fermi, and he was famous for doing kind of back of the napkin calculations.
Yeah.
I know I've mentioned this to you, where he would give his students an assignment and say, okay, estimate the total number of protons in the universe.
Yeah.
And they would be able to come up with a reasonable estimate. And the reason for that is that if you can think of the relevant parameters, some of them you're going to overestimate, some of them you're going to underestimate,
right.
and over multiple factors, the over and underestimations will cancel out.
Yeah.
And you end up with a good ballpark estimation based on very little initial data. Well, it I did a number of years ago in an Excel spreadsheet, you assume that 1.5 children survive to adulthood on average and get married, how fast would the world population grow? And it would be enormously big. So I could show just from that that it has to have been less. And then based on various factors, you can do the calculations of how many are likely.
Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, available each Friday. Today, we're doing weird questions with Jimmy Akin. There are lots more weird questions to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.